You are listening to Powder Radio. Brought to you by Powder Magazine.
Welcome to Sponsored, brought to you by Powder Magazine. I'm your host, Mike Powell, and this week on the program, we have David Lesh. And if you're not familiar with Dave, well, he is one of those people in skiing that a lot of people hate and a lot of people love. If you ask people in the ski industry about Dave, they'll tell you that he's got a trust fund and he's a super rich kid who is able to create his own brands and do whatever he wants based on his parents' money. But if you actually know Dave, you know that he does things his own way. He is the king of hustle, and every penny that he has earned has been by himself. He will tell us how he started his brands. He will talk about his escapades with Dan Blazarian, his photos with Obama, and all the things that make David Lesh tick. And it should be a fun story to tell, as Dave has a lot of controversy and a lot of fun going on in his life at all times. And enough of me talking. Let's get Dave Lesh on the line.
Hello, hello.
Dave, how's it going?
Let me get the dogs out of here. Dogs, come on, let's go. Out, go, go. I'm doing good, man. How's life?
Life is good. You know, I just found I had a broken dishwasher.
You know, all about all the things like broken dishwashers that happen. I just built a house basically and tried to like cheap out on some stuff. And of course, all that stuff breaks immediately. And I just realized that you have to buy the dopest shit brand new all the time, or it's just going to be an absolute headache. So
thinking about you and not buying the dopest shit is a surprise, because I figured you would buy the best, as whenever I see Lesh online, and I will say there's two Dave Leshes. There's the online persona and what people think, and then the dude I met 17, 18 years ago.
I'm the same dude. Don't get it confused. It just hurts to spend $800 on a dishwasher. You know, it's just fucking, I just bought a Bosch dishwasher. It just sucks to spend that much money on something that gives you no joy at all.
I totally agree. I was looking at your social media the past couple days. One thing that I noticed was the past few days, a lot of powder, which everybody else has as well. But you were doing it with Dan Blazarian. And how does that all happen?
Is this part of the interview now, or is this?
Oh, we've been interviewing Dave.
How does that happen? I met him a few years ago through a friend of a friend of a friend, and hung out with him in Colorado for some days and showed him around, took him snowmobiling. And we sort of hit it off. And then I was actually out in LA. I was doing a trip in my airplane this summer, and he invited me to come say hi to him at his place in Hollywood. So did that. And then he's big into snowmobiling. And so he always plans at least a few, you know, winter trips to go skiing or snowmobiling. And he just kind of last minute decided to go to Park City and hit me up and invited me to come along. So I obviously couldn't say no, and loaded up some sleds, cruised out there, and hung out with him for the past 5 days. And yeah, it was a great time. Got like just a ton of snow and did some skiing at canyons in Park City and went snowmobiling a few times and kicked it with him and his family and met the whole Bilzerian clan. So it was great.
So what was that whole prayer circle that you put on your Instagram? What was that all about?
No, I was just fucking around. That's actually this game that they play. They've been playing for a few years. It's like, it sounds so dumb when you try to describe it to people. It's called Werewolves. I think there's other versions of the game, but basically like everyone gets a different role, and then like it's one group's like job to try to kill the other group, and you sort of like lie and pretend to be other roles that you're not. It's really, really, really complicated. It's basically just a game that they've been playing forever.
Wow, it sounds like Dungeons and Dragons for Instagram folk.
It sounds absolutely terrible. His mom explained it to me, and I was like, oh my God, you guys got to be kidding me. But then it's actually kind of entertaining and interesting. So you got to kind of check it out in person to get a feel for it.
Well, he's a larger-than-life personality. But Dave, in the ski industry, you're really a larger-than-life personality. And I think I said in the intro that some people hate you, a lot of people love you, and a lot of people misunderstand who you are. And this podcast is going to be a great way to tell people who Dave Lesh is, both sides of Dave Lesh. Because there is a business side to Dave Lesh, but then there's also, I would say, the party side, but it's more than that with you. It's not like a full-on party side. It's, I can't even put it into words, the way you live your life, but I think if you watch any of your Friday videos, that's the other side of Dave Lesh that understands the art of getting people psyched on what he's doing.
Yeah, well, either psyched or really, really jealous and pissed off. A lot of people hate me, and most of those people haven't met me, or maybe they have, and just kind of quick to judge. But yeah, there's a lot of different sides to me, and I probably party less than, especially nowadays, less than what people might expect. But you know, when we do party, it does get pretty loose, and all the things in the video times 1,000 that I can't put in those videos happen on a pretty regular basis. So
you were friends with Ryan Schmies growing up in Wisconsin, and you had come out to Seattle. And when I say come out to Seattle, you were riding trains and jumping on trains, and you ended up in Seattle.
Yeah, that was the summer of 2003.
Okay, and so you came out and stayed with us, and I think Ryan said at some point to me, hey, my friend Dave's coming out, and I think I'd already met you, and he's like, can Dave stay at our house? We were going to be on a work trip for a few days. And he's like, can Dave stay at our house? Do you have any problems with that? And after meeting you a couple times at that point, I was like, actually, I think I might have a problem with it. And this is why. While Dave is an awesome guy, and I know our house would be the exact same as when we left, when we returned, I think 2 years from now, we'd hear about the party of the century that went down in our house and everything that happened that we didn't find out about. But Dave would be able to pull the wool over our eyes, be able to do that, and it would be totally fine.
No, that's nonsense. I would have taken good care. I wouldn't have done anything in your house. I don't even know that many people in Seattle. I would have just kicked it.
There's always a hustle, I feel like, to Lesh, and that's what's made you so successful throughout your life. Was it in Wisconsin where you were born?
I was born in Chicago and then moved to India when I was like, I don't know, 6 or 9 months old. And then I was in India until I was 6 and then moved to Madison after that. And then I was in Madison until high school and moved to Portland for a few years and then moved to Colorado.
Okay. How does India come together in the whole Lesh experiences of your family from India?
No, both of my parents are white. My mom really was the one who got all psyched on India. She's a cellist and my dad's a artist. And she just got all pumped on Indian classical music. She was actually living in Italy at the time, playing in an orchestra in Florence. And she had a month off and went to India and really fell in love with it. So she moved there and started studying the music. My dad, of course, followed. And then they came back to America to have me and then immediately went back to India. My sister was born there. My mom actually still lives there to this day. I'm sure she'll die there. My dad lives in Madison, Wisconsin. But yeah, my mom's been basically just obsessed with India her whole life.
And do you still make it back over there?
I went and visited her some years ago for like 2 months, and it was a trip. Definitely not the most comfortable place to travel. And it's a hard place to be, and I think I don't have any strong desires to go back. My mom's always trying to convince me to go visit her, but I'm sure I'll go again, but it's pretty low on the list.
Okay. Do you remember much of living in India, or is this childhood for you pretty much based in Wisconsin?
I have strong memories of living in India. You know, English was my third language. I learned Hindi and Marathi first and went to an English school and spoke some English at home with my parents, but for the most part, you know, I was speaking mostly Hindi and some Marathi. I grew up kind of like in a multicultural, multilingual sort of a situation.
Cool. Well, you get back to the U.S. and you're in Wisconsin. How do you get into skiing?
I played 21 seasons of soccer. I ended up making a private select club team for a while. I was pretty good at soccer. I played AA hockey, went to state. I started smoking a lot of weed in middle school and just kind of partying and hanging out with my friends. And my plan was to really get it together in high school, and that didn't work out so well. I was just having too much fun. So basically the way skiing came about is I really like playing sports. You know, I'm an athletic guy. I like to get some energy out and I like playing competitive sports. And for me, I couldn't really keep playing soccer and hockey because if you want to play high school sports, you have to go to school. And if you don't go to school, they don't let you play on the team. So I had no interest in going to school. So I decided to start skiing. I went skiing, you know, before high school, I went skiing maybe a handful of times. We had some middle school ski trips where we'd go skiing at nighttime after school on Friday nights, like Devil's Head and Cascade and Tyrol.
Okay.
I'd only been, you know, skiing a handful of times. I didn't even have my own gear. I was renting gear. I'd never had a season pass, but I did like skiing. It was fun. My friends and I would just, you know, get super high in the woods and ski down and steal food from the cafeteria and just be little crackheads.
Okay.
So I said, you know, maybe this is a good thing for me to do. At that point, I stopped playing soccer and hockey and I got my first season pass to Tyrol. My grandma bought me my first pair of skis. And I had boots, and I basically just skipped a lot of class and went skiing that winter. You know, got rides with older high schoolers and even hitchhiked out there a few times. But yeah, I just started skiing a bunch and really just fell in love with it in high school. And ended up meeting, you know, Schmies and Hammersley and Applegate and all those Midwest honkies. And we started going to comps around the Midwest and started competing. And it was really something that I liked and latched onto, and it was something that didn't have any rules, it didn't have any practice schedule, it didn't have any coaches, it didn't have a regimented vibe to it. I didn't have to get up early. It was just kind of this free-flowing, do-whatever-you-want sport. And at that time, obviously, you know, twin tips were not around. Twin tips, soon after, within a few years, came around with the 1080 and stuff like that. We weren't allowed in the half pipe. There was no rails. The sport was really in its early, early stages, and I give a lot of credit to Schmies and Hammersley and Applegate and those guys who really helped birth the sport, especially in the Midwest, where nobody had seen skiers doing the stuff that we were doing.
talking to Schmies, he had mentioned that you were a few years younger than the rest of the crew, and you were that guy that was super excited, chasing these guys around the mountain, and then eventually kind of became part of the crew. And how did your skills develop? Were you a good skier early on, or were you just hanging with the crew and trying to get better?
I was a decent amount younger, at least 3 or 4 years younger than those guys. I mean, I really looked up to them. You know, they were a lot better than me. I mean, there were these, you know, older, cool kids who kind of had their crew, and especially Applegate. I mean, Applegate is one of the more, you know, remarkable skiers that I've ever met. Super, super talented, naturally, you know, gifted guy. They were just way better than me, and I just sort of grew up looking up to them. In the beginning, I was not great by any means at all. And my style especially was just super hack. And style really in the beginning was not like a thing, you know, it was just how many spins could you do and maybe you can land, maybe you can't.
Were you pretty tall and awkward and lanky at that point?
Yeah, exactly. I was going through puberty and just growing, you know, a foot a day. Yeah, I was very tall and lanky and my style was just terrible. And, you know, I mean, there was no clothing back in the day that you could wear that was baggy and dope looking. You know, it was just all just super gaper shit.
Yep.
And my parents, you know, couldn't afford to buy me stuff. So I was just winning random gear at comps and wearing that, whatever kind of came together. And everyone was super hack. You know, Applegate would ski around in like rubber fishing waders. And I mean, it was a pretty ghetto scene. But yeah, then after high school, moved out to Oregon and really started like concentrating on style and like slowing down my spins and rotations and really, you know, working on grabs and focusing on really the style aspect of it, which I think was key for me.
Yes, but you're getting way ahead of the game here. So back in those Schmies and the Midwest All-Stars is what you guys called that crew. Back then, there was a nickname for you that Ryan has always referred to you as to me, and he's referred to Dave Lesh as the criminal, not because you engage in criminal activity, I think just because of your hustle and probably the way that you were, I'm assuming, able to graduate high school without going to high school very often. You probably talked your way through it. How did you get the nickname the criminal?
Oh, it was definitely because of criminal activity. Oh, my God. I mean, I was doing so much hot shit back in the day. I was charged with 2 felonies and 5 misdemeanors as a 7th grader.
Jesus.
As an 8th grader, I was expelled for doing a bomb threat, felony bomb threat, and kicked out of school. So I went to high school a quarter late. In high school, I got charged with probably between 5 and 10 felonies for stealing cars and motorcycles and mopeds and damaging property and selling weed. And I mean, just everything you could think of doing and more we were doing. And I had an ankle bracelet for a while. Actually, one comp that I went to with Schmies and those guys, we drove up to the UP and I had to obviously cut my ankle bracelet off because one, I couldn't put a ski boot on with the thing on, and two, I was going to leave the state anyway, which they were going to know, so I just cut it off, full well knowing that the consequence for me cutting off said ankle bracelet was 2 weeks in jail when I got back. And I actually ended up getting 3rd in the comp up there and got back to Madison. Sure enough, they threw the cuffs on me and off to jail I went for 2 weeks. So yeah, I think that the name The Criminal came about just because, yeah, I was always, you know, hustling and doing whatever I kind of needed to.
I feel like you have a fuck authority point of view, but it's to the point of making someone uncomfortable. I think if we were at a rail and a cop were to come and someone were to walk up and try to talk to the cop, you might go there and start being Dave Lesh and telling the cop how it is, hitting the rail the last time, and everybody's like, why the hell did you have to do that, Dave? Does that happen often with you?
Yeah, I do have a fuck authority attitude for sure, but I've dealt with police so much in my life now that I am very good at dealing with police. I do know my rights and I'm very, you know, calm and collected. I don't really say too much. I sometimes say nothing. And I really, at this point, have become pretty good at dealing with cops. So no, if we go to a rail and the cops show up, I'm probably the most respectful, calm dude there.
And that's just from experience and dealing with those guys.
Yeah. Yeah. There's nothing to be gained by flipping out and saying some stupid shit to a cop.
But did you do that when you were a kid?
I don't really think I ever did that too much with police. I mean, I definitely did it with, you know, these stupid security guards, these, you know, mall rat
yep.
security guards that think that they've got a bunch of power and just like to fuck with kids who are skateboarding around and stuff. I definitely did it with security guards and that kind of thing. And I definitely do have an issue with people who have either no power or very little power over using and over exercising that amount of power. There definitely have been some situations where we, you know, fucked with some mall security guards and stuff.
The thing is with you too is you're pretty clean cut from appearance. And you're smart and witty, and you can handle just about any person that's going to come up and try to mess with you, which is experience and then just who you are, and you've been able to do that. One story I did hear, I think it happened when you moved to Portland, but I'm not 100% sure, but there was a motorcycle chase that I heard about, and it sounded crazy.
Yeah. That was my first adult felony. So my plan was really, once I turned 18, to stop doing all the terrible things I was doing, because my hope was to have a clean adult record.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Canada one time and it didn't even matter. They saw all my juvenile stuff, the bomb threat and everything. They called me into immigration. They, Mr. Lesh, tell us about this bomb threat you did in, you know, seventh grade or eighth grade. I was like, oh, Jesus. So yeah, I thought all that stuff disappears, but it doesn't, FYI.
Right.
My goal was really to stop doing, you know, all the crazy stuff. But I was dumb enough to go. That actually was that summer that I came up and stayed with you guys in 2003. We were, you know, hopping freight trains and taking a road trip around the whole country for a few months. And I made the mistake of buying a crotch rocket in Santa Cruz. And I was driving it up the coast to Portland, where I was going to move. And I got in a high-speed chase at 140 miles an hour and wrecked the thing. And I got away, didn't get in any trouble. But it took me about 9 months or so to rebuild it. And then I still had not gotten a motorcycle license or insurance or registration. It was, you know, just a crotch rocket that I bought from some dude in the paper. Craigslist wasn't a thing then. So I rebuilt the thing. I was driving around and cop put its lights on to pull me over. And I just took off. And got away, but they set up a police net and they brought the dogs in, and these dogs almost ripped my head off. I was hiding in a bush, someone's backyard. And so I got caught for that, and parents told me to go fuck myself. I had no money for a lawyer at all. Got stuck with a public defender. I was 18. I had a clean adult record at that point. I should have been able to get it reduced at least to a misdemeanor, no problem, but that didn't happen. I totally got fucked. I spent a bunch of time in jail. I was on probation for a year and a half, and it was really a bummer deal. So yes, I'm now a felon and, you know, can't technically own firearms and that kind of thing.
Well, judging by your videos, you don't own firearms.
I've actually got a Glock right here. We got robbed this spring, so now I keep a loaded Glock by the bed. But
the warehouse got robbed?
Yeah, we got robbed by three dudes with masks and guns, and they're beating up my employee and threw my girlfriend on the ground, guns at the back of their heads, almost shot our dogs. It was a bad scene. They were looking for weed, which obviously we didn't have any here, so they took some cash of mine and took off, but we increased security a little bit after that.
So. I can imagine, yeah. So you're in Portland. And at this point, you're probably skiing every day and trying to get better. And I know that you're a hard worker. And I will say, in terms of professional skiers, you know, there's Candides and people that are upper echelon of professional skiers. I won't say you ever reached that high by any means, but you are a legitimate professional skier with sponsors. And no offense, I'd say middle of the pack professional skier, but you've done it in your own way. And you've done it without big sponsors behind you. And tell me how you have put the sponsors that you have together today.
Well, you know, I think what you said is more than generous. I, you know, definitely am not top level skier in the world. I think where I did excel was I was hitting some of the gnarlier, not really doing a ton of tricks on them, but hitting some of the gnarlier like urban rails for the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was decently good at that. And then my other kind of niche was when I started skiing big mountain stuff, being able to throw decent tricks off of natural hits. I was starting to kind of feel pretty comfy and good at that. And my other thing, really, to fully answer your question, what I became really good at was being a productive video and photo skier, where I was able to put together, you know, video parts and get good photos with photographers for magazines and articles. You know, I was hardworking. I could always get the shot. So, you know, if it took hiking the thing a few more times, or, you know, making, you know, 8 inches of powder look like it was 3 feet deep by various tricks, I always kind of get the shot. I think what I brought to the table to my sponsors was, still is, being able to produce content and have an input with product development and just kind of being a productive, marketable skier, not just somebody who sits around and gets high all the time and just expects the, you know, the money to flow in.
Sure. I know you work hard. And one thing I noticed throughout your career is you never filmed with the same people twice, it looked like. And you've had a ton of sponsors. And that can say you're tough to work with, or you're just bouncing around being a free spirit and going to the flavor of the day. Why have you not filmed with people more than one or two seasons and had so many sponsors?
Well, I mean, I skied for Liberty for...
That's true.
Forever. I mean, God, it was probably 8 years or 7 years or something. Then I skied for, you know, K2 for a while. I skied for Smith for 11 years until they just dropped their entire team last year, actually. So I did have some pretty, you know, long-term sponsorships. The way that all those movie parts work is your sponsor has to pay for your section. And so, you know, when you ski for smaller companies that don't have big budgets, especially like Liberty back in the day was, you know, just the crappiest skis you've ever skied in your life. And it was a small company with only a few guys. They didn't have much budget. And, you know, they weren't really able to get me into, you know, the movies that I wanted to. Like I filmed with Rage, and they, in a huge way, helped me get into that and start filming with Rage. And then, of course, the next year, Rage is done.
Right.
And I filmed with, you know, Level One for a year or two. I mean, sort of butt heads with Berman, and the sponsors didn't really want to make that happen. So that was really when I started kind of making my own little videos and edits and stuff. And then when I started my company, I just figured that it would be much more productive for me to make promotional Vertica edits and videos than it would be for me to try to be in somebody else's video.
And talking about starting a company, I think there's a big misconception in the ski industry that you are a full-on trust fund kid that has everything he wants from his parents, but you've already mentioned that your parents weren't even buying you gear back in the day, and they wouldn't get you a lawyer when you were 18 and needed one. So I can see that you don't have a trust fund and you've worked hard for what you've got, but you have a lot. And I think when people look at social media and they see the airplane, they see the warehouse, they see the parties, they just see that you have this money. But in 2009 or probably 2008 is when the ideas for First Drop came together. And tell me how you went about starting a company, because you did it different than most people I know would do it. And I think it's a valuable lesson to kids out there to see how to start something up.
Yeah, and I think, although maybe it is a valuable lesson, I don't know how easy it would be for other people to do what I did. I've never had a trust fund. My parents have no money. And I started the company with a total of $2,012. And basically, I had to do everything myself. There was no way I was going to have any money to hire people to do anything. So, you know, I took all the photos myself. I made the website myself. I set up the payment gateway. I built the team. I designed the products. I built the size charts. I found the factories. I did everything myself. And I had no employees for the first year. So I spent basically $2,012 on samples and domain hosting, email hosting, just kind of your basic stuff, shipping for the samples. And then with those samples, took photos, created the website. And I had enough pull in the ski community that I could put my name on the line and say, hey, you know, I'm a reputable person and I'm creating some outerwear, and buy it and I won't screw you over. So people placed their pre-orders, and I took the pre-order money and funded production with pre-order money, basically, and kind of grew it from there. I never had any loans, never had any lines of credit or bank loans, any of that. I may, you know, had a personal credit card with a few grand limit or something, but that was pretty much it.
Did you head over to China and find these factories yourself?
Yeah. When I started the company, when I started Vertica in 2009, that summer, I couldn't afford to go to China myself. I would have loved to go, but there was no way that I had the money to do that. So I found factories online myself. I found a first factory, well, multiple factories for clothing and outerwear online, and just did everything through email and Skype. And then as soon as the company started blowing up, really was not happy with the quality of the stuff we were getting. So I went to China that next year and found new factories myself in China. And I've gone back to China every 1 or 2 years since 2009. I'm actually going back again this spring.
And I guess you're a world traveler. You grew up in India, so it's probably not too crazy for you going over there. But when you're finding warehouses, do people look at you as like the dumb white guy who doesn't know what he's doing, or are they actually treating you with respect? How does that work?
Oh, no. I mean, the Chinese, you know, they love tall Americans. I never get the feeling that they look at me as a dumb white person. I think they idolize Western culture and Hollywood and white people in general, and anyone from America. But the language barrier can be tough. The food is absolutely inedible for the most part, especially in rural China where the factories and stuff are. And yeah, the first time I went to China, I was just so excited. You know, I love Asian culture. I love Asian food. And I've always wanted to check out China. So the first time I remember being just super excited. And now I'm like, oh God, I got to go to fucking China. So we try to break it up with some time in Thailand, or a little bit of time in Hong Kong, Macau, somewhere to break up the time spent in China.
So you've got this company off the ground, and it's pretty successful kind of off the bat, correct?
Yeah, it really took off right away, a lot more than I ever expected. I was actually in school full-time, living in a little one-bedroom apartment on the hill in Boulder. And I actually finished that semester of school and got all A's, maybe a B or two. But yeah, I got, you know, 3.8 or something that semester, and then never went back after that.
Okay. And at this point, do you have a relationship with your family, or are you kind of on an island by yourself?
My mom had already moved back to India. So then and now I'll see my mom every few years, maybe.
Okay.
She actually came and stayed with me for a month this summer, which was good to catch up with her. She came to the warehouse, stayed here at the warehouse in Denver. But there was some period of years where I was pretty not pumped on my parents, didn't really talk to them at all for, I don't know, some years. But we got over that and everything is good now. And so during that time, I was in a lot of communication with my dad, who was helping me, you know, with various ideas for the company and logo design and just kind of artistic visual stuff. But yeah, my mom was in India, so yeah, I wasn't able to talk to her or see her too much.
Okay. And you know, I think it was 2011 when you put together Last Friday. The video content that you're putting out is something that rappers wish they could put together. I mean, it's like the best rap video you've ever seen, but taking it up four levels. And the way it's put together in those videos, I can see why some people are offended. I can see why others like myself love them. And how does the concept of that video come together? Is it all from the creation of Lesh? How much does it cost to put one of those videos together? And then tell me about the fallout.
All right, that's a lot of questions. I think I can remember them all. So last Friday, we filmed it in, it was either 4 or 5 days, we filmed the entire video.
Wow.
I didn't own a video camera at the time, so I actually flew out a kid who I met on New Schoolers. I think he was in high school at the time. I flew him out to Colorado and paid his way in exchange for him filming the video. And I edited it. I conceptualized it. It's a video that I've been wanting to make forever. I mean, who doesn't love guns and girls and rallying and, you know, skiing? I was just kind of a no-brainer. And my concept was always to put together, you know, all the ski edits throughout time have always just been kind of ski porn, where it's just music to skiing. And I wanted to kind of make it a little more interesting than that, a little bit more developed. I wanted to cram it all into one day, this one epic day. Kind of like Candide now. He's cramming all this crazy stuff into one run. And obviously, he's not doing it all in one run. It's creating some interest. It's creating a storyline.
Sure.
And so that was my goal, was to take all these elements and combine them into one day and into a storyline, basically. So flew the kid out and we filmed it in 4 or 5 days. I edited it and we threw it online. And to be totally honest, I expected it to get some people's attention, but the effect that it had was a lot more than I had anticipated. And it was really an interesting thing because the company had already really taken off and we were growing 600% a year and the company was doing really well. And nobody in the ski industry had ever made a video like that before, and I didn't think anything of it. It was like nothing. We filmed it in a few days in Breckenridge. You know, it was just like a wham bam, super quick, nothing thing. And I threw it together, you know, edited it in maybe a week, and everyone around the world was just freaking out. You know, people are calling the cops. We're all getting fired from our coaching jobs at CU. I'm getting removed from CU campus property. I mean, we had customers calling in from around the world. I was pulled over by the police 5 times. I mean, it was like this whole ordeal. There were people online saying, oh my God, you wiggers, you've ruined your company and this is going to be the end of your company. And I hope you're, you know, I was just like, they call this shit. And I was like, oh my God, like maybe they're right. You know, like maybe this is the end of Vertica. I don't know. I didn't know anything at the time. I didn't know what was going to happen. And of course, always people, the naysayers and the haters who speak the loudest. And you have a lot of other people who are like, you know, this is dope. Nobody's done this before. These guys don't give a fuck. And you know, if you have half a brain, you can see that we're not just some wiggers who think that we're gangsters. We're just kids out there having fun and putting together entertaining content. And so it really helped us immensely. I mean, it got people talking. It's hard to get noticed as a small company up there against, you know, these big players in the industry. And it got people talking. It got people sharing the video with their friends. And the video went relatively viral, got a few 100,000 views, and really gave us something that set us apart from all the other bland, boring companies out there that have PC marketing. And then we made the apology video, obviously, which wasn't apologizing for anything.
Right.
And then we did the whole spoof with New Schoolers pretending that I got arrested for running away from the cops in my car and crashed my car and had the fake mugshot. And we kind of played that into everything. And then we made This Friday trying to just take everything to the 10th degree. And then we made Next Friday. With each video, we tried to diversify the music and diversify the action and still have all the core elements that we wanted, but change things up a little bit for interest and also incorporate elements throughout all of them that were a little bit more humorous and lighthearted to let people know that we're not serious about it.
Yeah, if you haven't seen these videos, one's last Friday, one's this Friday, one's next Friday. There's also the Dave Lesh apology video, which spoofs LeBron James. What video did you drop today?
We dropped a video with one of our riders, Katrina, and we made this music video. Basically, everyone on social media and New Schoolers is so young. They think that our rider, Trina, is actually rapping this song and wrote the song and fancies herself a rapper, which she definitely does not. But the video that we made is a remake of an actual Trina video, and there's clips throughout the video of Trina in our video. And Trina, the rapper, is known as the baddest bitch, and so our rider, Katrina, has always had a similar marketing to her ski personality, which is like she's the baddest bitch. So she had on New Schoolers, I don't know if you remember, some years ago, she had this series, Sexual Wednesdays, where she's really one of the first like women skiers to kind of tug at the heartstrings of these horny 13-year-old, you know, ski boys on New Schoolers.
Right.
Which was really, you know, smart. I mean, she's using her sexuality to gain attention and notoriety and set herself apart, which is similar to what we've done. She just so happens to have gone to CU Boulder, and I was her ski coach for many years, so I thought it would be a great fit to sponsor. She's a super smart chick. She's actually an engineer. She probably won't be skiing for that much longer because she's going to be going off to the professional world, but I thought it'd be a good fit, at least for the time being, to sponsor her. And she, calling herself Trina, the baddest bitch, you know, doing these Sexual Wednesdays, we thought it'd be fun to kind of push that to the next level and make a video where we kind of remake a Trina video, which incorporates skiing and has a bunch of girls in it for interest. And so we made the video, didn't really think too much of it, put it online, and everyone's all up in arms because they don't know that there actually is a rapper Trina, and they don't know that we are basically just remaking that video and incorporating skiing, and they think that our rider is trying to be a rapper or something. So it's funny kind of how dumb people are, but either way, it gets people talking regardless. So at least just something to keep us in the forefront of people's minds and stay relevant.
Well, I will say it was very well done. If she didn't smile towards the end and break character for just 1 second, I mean, it looked like she was rapping that video. It was pretty awesome.
Well, yeah, thanks. We had a good time making it. We filmed it actually last winter, and it just so happened to be a blizzard in the middle of downtown Denver, which worked out really well for the video.
So one thing with your last Friday video, and I don't know if it was last Friday, this Friday, or next Friday, but you dropped one of these videos, and then it must have been 3 weeks later, there's a photo of Dave Lesh on the internet standing with Obama, looking official in a nice suit. And how does that one come together, and what do all the haters say to that picture?
Yeah, that was actually very interesting timing with the whole thing. But yeah, I think you're right. It was right after one of the Friday videos. And I can't believe Secret Service, because they vet all the people that meet Obama, you know, meet the president. They vet him, and I'm sure they saw those videos. I mean, I don't know how it was that they still let me meet him, but they did. The way that came together is I was hooking up with this chick at the time who had a friend who was doing advanced planning for the White House. I mean, everywhere they go, they need people to help drive the presidential motorcade. This is kind of how it all tied together. He was coming to Denver, coincidentally enough, to give talks about small business and various programs and incentives for small business. So I not only was able to drive a White House staff van in the motorcade, but I was also able to meet him and talk with him for, you know, maybe 15, 20 minutes and then get my photo taken with him. And I talked to him about Vertica and small business and the whole deal. And it was, yeah, it worked out super well. And then put all that stuff online, and I was actually had an opportunity to have lunch with him then the next day. But it's a part of the deal of being able to do that is you're not supposed to use your interaction with him for any personal financial gain. And I definitely marketed it heavily with Vertica. And so the Secret Service saw that and they canceled the luncheon for the next day.
Always doing a little less right there.
I mean, you know, it had to happen. It is what it is.
Okay, I've got a few more questions and they'll be quick hits, and a lot of them relate to your videos. In thinking of this Friday, and they probably all are blur to you now, but you're in a car, you flip that car and then end up driving again. Were there any injuries in that? It looked like a pretty gnarly crash.
Oh, no, that was nothing. So have you ever seen the MIA music video that she's on top of a car and they're in the Saudi Arabia or something driving cars on two wheels?
I vaguely remember it.
It's an unbelievably well shot music video. I love that music video. But I saw that music video and I've also seen, you know, this stunt done. I mean, they've been doing it since the 30s. But I really wanted to put a car on two wheels, and my concept was to drive a car on two wheels with naked girls on top of it shooting machine guns. So I wanted to take her concept and incorporated into our video. And so I bought that Isuzu Trooper, welded the spider gear and the rear diff together to lock the rear two wheels so that, you know, when you go up on two wheels, it still sends power to the bottom wheel. We built the whole ramp. I mean, we went through the whole deal of it. We lined up a parking lot and we had cameramen and the whole setup. Our plan was to put the car on two wheels. Well, we really ran out of time with making the edit, and all of a sudden it was like February or March and we had to finish filming if we wanted to get the edit out. So we just real quick went to a parking lot. It was like freezing cold, and the key for that stunt, to get a car on two wheels, you really need to have decent tires and you need to have warm pavement.
Okay.
Neither of which we had. We had freezing cold. It was, you know, negative 15 degrees or whatever, and freezing cold, and the tires were just some like super shitty four ply or whatever, you know, junk tires were on there. So we could not for the life of us get this thing onto two wheels. So after, you know, an afternoon of trying to get it onto two wheels, which was not going to happen, we were like, all right, well, fuck it. Let's just try to flip the thing, you know, and maybe we can catch it once it starts to kind of flip. Maybe, you know, we can catch it and get on the two wheels. And so in the video, you see us just, you know, whipping it as hard as we can to try to flip it. And B was like, dude, let me drive. What the fuck is wrong with you? Can't you flip this goddamn Trooper? This thing's top heavy as hell. So B gets in there and he whips the thing around as hard as he possibly can, you know, for 20 minutes, cannot flip it. And finally, I was like, I'm doing it. So tires were like warm enough at that point to sort of grab. And we found that parking lot that sort of had like a little half pipe kind of shape in the bottom of it, which helped the tires hook up.
Okay.
We were just whipping it as hard as I could left to right to get this thing to go. And the shot in the video is of it finally flipping. And that was what we were trying to do. And we both, if you look in, you know, the video, we both kind of know what to do. We put our hands in, and because the windows were open, we didn't want to, you know, get our hands smashed underneath the car or whatever. We just kind of went into the tuck mode and stomped it. We were totally fine, not a scratch. And we kicked the roof back, welded a little roll cage because we were just going to still try to put it on two wheels. Never ended up working out. But then we just filmed the rest of the video with no windshield, no windows, and rallying it around, shooting guns out of it.
All right, next question relating to these videos. In Next Friday, you guys impersonated the homeless. Did you hear any flack for that?
No, I don't remember hearing a single, of all things, I don't think we heard a single piece of bad press about that. So the way the Next Friday concept came about, so last Friday was, it is what it is. Next Friday was like all the same stuff times 10 kind of a thing. This Friday was that, and then Next Friday was supposed to kind of like flip it around. So instead of me pouring milk on girls, girls pouring milk on me. Instead of me waking up in a bed full of naked girls, I wake up in a dumpster full of naked dudes. Instead of, you know, being rich and balling out, we all start out as being broke homeless people that have to like work our way up throughout the day to become basically ourselves again. So that was how that concept came to be.
Okay, my last question relating to these videos. You have a pretty gnarly kite crash.
Yeah, it was a speed wing. And yeah, that was on Oprah and Fail Army and the whole deal. That was definitely one of the moments in my life where I was pretty sure I was going to die. We were in Crested Butte filming on this frozen lake, and my two friends who are brothers, we were on a $20,000 turbocharged sled, and there was a pretty strong wind. And so because of the wind, I told them that, hey, you guys don't have to go very fast. We just barely putt, putt, putt. And of course, he just got a little happy on the throttle. And there's something called toe lock. Toe lock happens when basically you overexert the forces of what that wing can hold. It's being pulled one direction too hard, and the wing's pulling it back the other direction, and the wing becomes uncontrollable, which is why I basically just got towed into the ground from 60 feet up and in the air, accepted my death. And I've been in some pretty gnarly car crashes and stuff, and I know it's good if you just totally relax every muscle. So I just accepted my death and got really relaxed. And, you know, you can see in the video, it's hard enough to pull over a snowmobile with two people on it.
Right.
And I went down into the ground, probably 5 or 6 feet, made a really nice bomb hole, and had a full face helmet on. The rope cinched around my waist and I couldn't breathe. And I thought I broke a few ribs, but I think it was just bruised. And I was fine. I had a few bruises and a black eye, but I was totally fine. And it was nothing less than a miracle.
Dave, I think that's a good summary for your whole life, man. A few bruises, a couple black eyes, but nothing less than a miracle, because what you've done with your career, man, you've done it a way that no one else has. And anybody that's told you you can't do it, I'm sure you've given them the finger or laughed silently to yourself, and you've proved everybody wrong. One final question. Have you gotten rich off this whole thing?
Well, I mean, I started off with nothing, and I definitely have a lot more than when I started off. So it's a constant work in progress. I have definitely become more financially smart than I was in the beginning. And by no means am I some, you know, super rich dude, but I am able to maintain an awesome lifestyle and go where I want and do what I want and buy what I want. And my plans in life, I have higher aspirations than where I'm currently at, and hope to continue to start companies and do things that hopefully at some point will make me a rich dude.
Well, Dave, in the way that we are in the world today, there's no reason why you can't be president of this great country of ours.
Except I'm a felon, so I can't.
I mean, that could always change, man. Don't think anything's certain anymore. I want to thank you for your time coming on Sponsored, and I'm sure I'd like to talk to you again because there's a ton of stories I didn't touch on. But Dave Lesh, thanks for your time, man.
Yeah, thanks. Good talking to you, pal.
So that was Time with the Criminal, David Lesh, and you can find out more about Dave on Vertica.com. Next week on the Powell Movement, we have Inappropriate Questions with Dave, but we also have Pat Bridges, the creative director of Snowboarder Magazine, on the Powell Movement show. That launches every Monday, so check that out on thepowellmovement.com. As always, if you have any show feedback, you can reach me at PowellMovement1 on Twitter or shoot me an email at Mike@thepowellmovement.com. Thanks, everyone. Have a great week, and talk to you next week.